We're talking about the mythological series that we've been doing of mythical immaculate myth conceptions. And we've been working lately on thinking about humor and positiveness, and that a lot of our conversations and episodes are really trying to instill a sense of mixing fiction and fact to tell the truth, but also with some humor, and thinking that maybe we have something to learn. And sometimes, as Oscar Wilde said, that if you put a mask on somebody, they'll tell you the truth. So we put a mask on. But we were thinking about Norman Cousins and his insightfulness in learning how humor and laughter really took back his life. He was on a deathbed. And
yeah, he was dying of a terminal disease.
A terminal disease?
Terminal, yeah.
I mean, really terminal.
Yeah, serious.
And
he cured himself when he realized he actually saw the letter from one doctor to another basically saying this guy's terminal. And then he realized how serious it was, and then he decided, like, when the situation's that serious, you better get serious about getting better. And you have to take personal responsibility for your disease, and then you have to look. Like, these days, people, I think a lot of people are starting to do that, and they go online and they research their disease and they look at alternative cures, and then they go out and they follow the protocols and they make every effort. And I think that's what you need to do, because you can't just accept a death sentence from a doctor. And doctors have to be very careful about giving those, because a lot of people live and die according to expectations.
Well, here we are in the Penn Station and a train station where people live and die and go here and there and everywhere, and we're having this conversation. But in reality, to me, what we've been doing is putting a little twist on some insightfulness and a little playfulness mixed with some positiveness, even in our most negative portrayals.
Yeah, even when I'm portraying a racist, I like to do it with so much enthusiasm that it becomes ridiculous.
It's so convincing that you scare the shit out of me.
Yeah.
You even wake me up.
So there's there's good Texans and there's bad Texans, and there's good white folks and bad white folks, and I like to show the difference between the two. You know, this Willie Nelson is a good old boy, and he's a good white man, and then there's the head of the KKK, and he's a bad white man, and so but even with the bad ones, you got to show where they come from and where their background is and their training and their brainwashing, and you have to bring a sense of humanity to even, like, how do people get that way?
Well, it's interesting that there's a lot we can learn from all of these different circumstances. I think that one of the things that keeps on echoing through me is how we, like, for instance, we did this whole piece on narcissism tonight.
Right.
And what was interesting is that you brought up the ultimate narcissist.
Right, of the modern age.
Of the modern age. And I was playing God.
And you couldn't beat me.
I couldn't beat you.
Yeah, I was just so... That's what he learned from Roy Cohen, his lawyer.
Who's better than God.
Just repeat, even if you lose, never admit it, and keep lying about the truth until you convince people just by you wear them down.
Right. Which is interesting, because what are many episodes of mythological misconceptions have really countered the negativity often, but not only that. I think we have a positive message. I always feel like, even in our darkest period, we're still positive.
Absolutely, and one reason we're positive is because, like, here we are. Two
outsiders, white
outsiders,
guys.
white guys, and like a friend of mine said, you know, where do you think that anybody is going to listen to, like, two old white guys who were like talking to each other? Like, what's so exciting about the conversation, and you know, makes you think that anybody's ever going to listen to this? And it takes a certain esperanza, a certain belief, a certain hope that you are engaged in something important that would be meaningful to, and there that you know, this can have a crossover audience, that we're not just talking to ourselves and laughing at our own jokes, but that that the communication will find some ground, common ground, in and among a larger demographic than you might suspect. And so it's a question of, like, making people from all different kinds of backgrounds accessible, and using humor as one of the hooks, because the truth is, everybody can use a good laugh, and everybody who's got could use a little distraction, a little entertainment in their lives, and they seek it out like bees seek out honey. And I always, you know, my girlfriend would say, which movie do you want to see? And I say, show me the funny one and the one that gives me hope. And that's what I need. I need hope, and I need humor. And, you know.
Well, it was interesting and insightful on the Norman Cousins. YouTube videos we saw. I didn't realize about his, what was the name of his book?
His book, The Anatomy of an Illness. He was the first guy in the modern age who actually brought something new to bear on the serious subject of health. And he was really the guy who made people realize that humor is medicine, and it's legit. And it's not just humor, but hope and love and compassion. And the belief that you could take responsibility for your own health and your own life, and that would make the difference, that you were a participant. It wasn't just happening to you, you were making it happen, and you were fighting. And he was the one who, you know, fight with every tool in your arsenal, and if humor is that tool, use it.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who are involved these days in wellness
and happiness.
There's even a degree, and a friend of mine got in happiness in Harvard University.
Oh, that's great! You know, because they actually, even in certain countries, they've instituted not GNP, gross national product, but gross national happiness, where they measure it. They go out and they measure happiness and try to ask people questions, like, you know, to discern, like, how happy are you? How happy do you feel? And they actually, sociologists are studying this, and that's why a country like Denmark supposedly has the happiest people in the world by objective measurement.
But also, Sweden had one of the highest suicide rates, and so does the Scandinavian country. So I'm not sure about Denmark.
Well,
they have everything. They don't have any struggle, it is said, and you need struggle to be happy. So
I've seen the
happiest people I've seen are the poorest, often because they have nothing, and everything is a gift sometimes.
Most of the scientists who say, they say the formula that seems to work best is when you have a little more than you need, where you're not totally stressing out, like, about, am I going to have food tomorrow? Can I pay the rent tomorrow? You know.
Well, I think community is one of the keys to happiness, in terms of people genuinely feeling cared for and comforted, and that's why people belong to groups, the religions, or sports, politics. I don't even think they really care, as long as they belong, because our biggest fear
absolutely.
Is not belonging.
Yeah, and being isolated, and we're social animals, and we need to be in a group, and also to feel safe, because just like wolf packs, if you're a wolf alone, you're going to starve. because you can't bring the caribou down. You need a pack so many times just to get what you need to sustain yourself or to protect yourself. You need a group of people. You need a group of wolves. If you're on your own, you're going to be out of luck. So that's why the social need is key. And that's why even skills like, which I make fun of by saying, you know, I play multiple personalities and I speak different languages and have opinions that mirror the behaviors of other people, because I did notice that people tend to like people like themselves, and if you want them to like you, be like them. And so if you and that's well known, and that's what anthropologists call mirroring language, and it's body language and it's behavior, and you do what other people do and they like you because you do what I do, and you're like me, and so that's a basic rule. And but it's also very funny when you're just putting it on, and it's not really you, but it's what's needed and necessary. So that's why I learned that skill as a kid growing up, going to 12 schools in 12 years, and you learn to adapt your behavior and your performance in each school, in each location. And it's a, I think it's a survival skill. It's adaptability.
Well, I also think that trust and intimacy play a strong role. Let's look at our bodies. They're made up of trillions of cells, and for the most part, they trust each other.
That's
you look
true.
You look at people. Do they trust each other?
And they trust the ones who are like them, and they don't trust the ones who are not like them. That's why xenophobia or the fear of strangers is even in your body. You have the soldiers going around or saying, are you you or are you something else? Are you a foreigner invading this body to take it over and do it harm, or are you part of this body? And if you're part of the body, you're okay. If you're a foreigner or an invader, you're not okay, and we're going to fight you to the death. And that's how it works. And so sometimes it's knowing the password and identifying yourself as a good old boy. I'm a good old boy, just like you are. You know, that's why us folks got to stick together. We got to be supporting each other, and it's just a Christian thing to do. You know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. As you play these characters on in your mindless mind of meandering metaphors.
But you know, that's what you know what I'm talking about. But if you you know, if you also even say it in another language, there's a common language, and I know what the words and the concepts are in another language, like in a Muslim country, where the term Allah Akbar, God is great, is giving credit to God, and that's what good people do, because everybody recognizes that without some larger force in the universe supporting you, that most difficult projects will fail. That what makes the success of something is determined by whether or not God is a willing participant in your project.
Well, you know, that's...
And that's their perception.
Everybody's individual perceptions and belief system. I tend to look at groups and ask the question, who are we? Are we nations, religions, or human beings first? What makes us connect to each other?
Well, and you know, tribalism is still very much alive, and demographers break the United States down into 53 subcultures. So they define you according to your existence within one of those subcultures. And
so we have a fearless leader who defines you're with us, you're with me, or you're against me.
Yeah, and he's managed to appeal to a certain segment of U.S. society, and those people go along with him and will support him. And sometimes, like I was listening to a guy just recently, you can actually go to it. You should check it out. It's called Q, and it's all about people who are like devoted Trump supporters who believe he's the good guy and the promised savior of ages, and that he's here to drain the swamp and to correct what's wrong in the United States. And they say that 9/11 was an inside job and that everything is going to be exposed, and it would take a guy like him, who's a total outsider, to expose all the corruption that's been going on in Washington way beyond what your expectations are.
I have to think it's kind of humorous. Here is this guy who was born with a silver spoon, has a golden toilet, has never worked a real day in his life, has taken advantage of working people who helped build his buildings and his empire, and that his followers are the working people.
Yeah, working people. Working class and with a lower educational status. And that's his best supporting.
And these are the people he's notoriously screwed over.
Yes.
And they expect him to save him. So I have...
There's definitely humor in that. And
a tragic comedy. If he gets his way, we'll all be slaves, maybe.
Yeah, well... Yeah, but if you watch the documentary I saw, the guy presenting it to me really believed Donald Trump was the savior. And when you watch the video, it's actually very slick production and very well done. And you could see why people who don't know better might go along with it. So I do try to put myself in people's position and see where they're coming from and why they believe what they do. And that's why even when I'm portraying somebody that I disagree with totally, I try to do my best job. And sometimes I may go over the top a little and make fun of them in that way, but I also try to present them sometimes in a humane way where you could see how somebody could actually believe something like that.
Well, interesting. I love the... we've done a number of Trump tragic comedy explorations, but this one with the narcissism was quite I don't know, just got my attention.
We
haven't done one in a while.
And he is actually
a great fodder for the imagination.
He is, and for comics everywhere.
Right. Yeah. And we're not the only ones.
He's a gold mine.
absurdities, but it's such a tragic comedy that his idea of like he said to the leader of the dictator of North Korea, he said, "Oh, I want to get my people to sit at attention when I come in a room."
Yeah. Absolutely.
I said, there's a revealing...
That's leadership.
That's leadership.
Yeah.
He was impressed that they sat at attention.
Yep. Yeah.
For the whole time he was there.
Yeah, but you know, they recognized that he could get them killed if he doesn't like them for any reason. Just
right.
I don't like the way you looked at me. I don't like the way you said that. You're dead.
Well, it's all about fear. You know, that's what governments and religion are, you know, they talk about love and caring and being, even Hitler, Führer.
Yeah, he had both people who were in love with him and people who feared him. And you want to be on my good side, right?
Right. This is just a very absurd... So this kind of community and belonging has, as you were talking about in one of the pieces, has humor. What was that piece we just did where you were talking about the good sides can often be used?
I was just saying, that was the one I was talking about, you know, the purpose-driven life.
Right.
But
we got far away from the purpose-driven life.
I was trying to introduce humor into a subject where some people are capitalizing on the message, because the reality is that purpose does drive individuals and groups in good and in bad ways. And sometimes it seems very positive, but you have to be aware that there is a darker side and a negative side to it. And that's why I introduced the humor, because it's trying to sort of like poke fun at the seriousness of it, because there's some people out there that are out there making a fortune on the purpose-driven life and how it can make a critical difference to your success as a human being if you simply identify those things which are meaningful to you and to that give meaning to your life. And, you know, so there are people out there and they've got their stump speech and they're out there speaking at conferences around the United States and the world, and they're making $10,000, $20,000.
Right.
And the sermons are delivered by these ministers from mega churches. And when the sermon is well done and they write a book on the 12 principles of a purpose-driven life or whatever, they make a lot of money. And so it comes down to money, and if you sell books and you make money, you get respect, and so you got money plus respect. Hey, sounds like I'm doing good.
Right, right. Meanwhile, you're
it's basically about exploiting a human weakness and a need. And the question is it a need for meaning and a need to be a member of a group? And what's the difference between the reality is that the planet is facing its own extinction at the hands of human beings, and will they turn around and act constructively together to save it in time?
Well, then again, you have all these tele-evangelists and other evangelists who are promoting their own egos.
Absolutely. And they're also promoting laziness, because they're basically telling people, and I think it's a very bad message, that you don't need to do anything because Jesus will do it for you.
That's another
escape. Don't get involved in politics, don't get involved in the world, just focus on spreading the good news about accepting Jesus as your personal savior. And
but we should say we're not for or against religion, we're just
We're against the misuse of it.
Man's aberrations.
Yeah, because
anything.
I actually did grow up in a Judeo-Christian tradition and in a Catholic family, and I bought the message hook, line, and sinker, and I'm actually trying to do my job, but with some sense of humor about it. And so Jesus is my friend, and he does show up in my dreams and talk to me.
Well, that's good. And with that, but you have to catch a train?
Yes, I have to catch it at 12. What time is it?
It's 12:04.
Okay, well, it's a good time to go then.
Okay, well, we shall continue.
Yes, we shall continue. Au revoir. Mm.